and with the patriotic sounds of America behind us, let's get to the one thing that we are known for in America, and that is politics. The first Sunday. Jim Pomeroy likes that. Anyway, first Sunday politics, first Sunday roundtable, in order, in session. And this morning, let's get started as I introduce our guest, Eric. Let's start with Nicholas. Nicholas Sawalk, good morning, sir.
Good morning, Jerry. Happy 4th of July.
What does it mean to you?
It means freedom and liberty and the ability for all Americans to live their own lives and pursue their own dreams.
From a libertarian to a Republican, Jim Pomeroy.
Thanks for having us again.
What does the 4th mean to you?
What does it mean to me? Well, it means that a little over 200 years ago, we beat the odds and knocked off the largest military power in the world, Great Britain, and won our independence. And independence has to be fought for, not just handed to you.
Emily Leffler, independent.
Good morning, Jerry. Well, remembering the 4th of July, I think, is a time to remember, again, how we got to this place, why we're here, the roots of our freedom and independence in the Constitution, and to examine what that really means to us today.
From independent to Democrat, Patrice McKinney.
Good morning, Jerry. Happy 4th of July. And to me, the 4th of July means that we can continue to have wonderful programs like this where all points of view can be aired over the airwaves, and we all have a chance to speak our minds.
And last but not least, Eric Nicholson, Green Party.
Hello, Jerry. How are you? The 4th means, I think, you know, our previous folks have said a lot of good things, liberty, freedom, to the ability to exercise our rights as enshrined in the Constitution and to pursue our happiness.
Okay. So the 4th really means something to a lot of people besides going out and eating hamburgers. What's wrong with this round table? You guys are so quiet.
In my family,
it's solidly patriotic today. You go to sleep on us.
Fireworks. It means fireworks.
Fireworks. Oh, boy. Okay. Question on topic number one. How successful will the new Iraqi government be? And will it cost the American taxpayer more big bucks than lies? Go to it. Jim Pomeroy, I'll start with you.
Wow. Now, there's a loaded question. Look, I think we've had a pretty good last week or so in Iraq. It's been pretty good. We've transferred the power over to Iraqis, and now it's time for them to step up, and the mass of Iraqis to step up and deserve their freedom. They have to, can't just sit back and expect the United States to give them everything. They have to step up and stop the terrorism themselves, and I think they're taking the first steps toward doing that, and I think we're moving in the right direction.
Jerry, I think what we have this week in Iraq is a transfer of power from the Pentagon to the State Department in the United States, and I think that's a good move because the State Department is really the appropriate agency to be handling this matter.
Anybody else?
Well, I think that the success of the new government is going to depend a lot on how much the Iraqis across the board recognize feel about the legitimacy of the new government, and also how long the 135,000 troops that are still in that country and retain some independence from the rule of law in that country, how long they remain there and it's still seen as an American occupation.
I think we have a good example for this. The British actually liberated what's now Iraq. Actually, they made Iraq right after World War I and liberated the Iraqi people from the Turks, and had this same sort of transfer of power to a government that was primarily composed of British advisors and local people who were loyal to the British crown, and it didn't work so well. The people didn't really see a lot of legitimacy there, and there's something we should remember on 4th of July, that the way this country was founded was we, as Americans living here as colonists, decided that we wanted representation, and we revolted against the British crown to take our independence and take our liberty back from those who had taken it from us. We didn't have people come in and quote-unquote liberate us. We didn't have our freedom handed to us by some sort of third party, and I don't think, just looking at history, it doesn't bode well for an independent government in Iraq for their whole system to have been set up by us and actually still run by us. I mean, the American presence there is huge, And the transfer of power is mostly symbolic. I mean, we've supposedly given Saddam Hussein to the independent Iraqi government, but he's still in our prison. It's just legally he's sort of their responsibility now. I think that there's a lot more noise than there is actual action here, and I hope to see more independence for the Iraqi people.
Eric Mickelson, how much will this cost the American taxpayer? We're going to see bigger bucks going out of this country.
Well, just to respond to the two initial questions that you asked, yes, I believe it will cost more big bucks and more lives. You know, we can expect tens at least of billions of dollars, if not hundreds of billions. You know, hopefully as few as possible service people and civilians will lose their lives. But I think there's no question that both will occur.
Returning to the historical perspective, one of the problems that the British had was after they had taken what is now Iraq from the Turks and given it to the local people, because they implemented a British system of government, all of the money from the new economy that was no longer being taken by the Ottomans was instead being funneled into building British power structures. And so the people of Iraq didn't become prosperous or independent because of the massive amount of overhead and cost of oil revenue that it required to prop up this British system. And we have the same situation where we are creating a government for Iraq that is more attuned to our governance here. We're a country that's been here for a long time. We have a lot of money. Iraq is new and struggling.
But what would you pick? What form of democracy would you? I mean, if you had the choice, what would you say we should do differently? We're giving them
a
free election.
If I was an Iraqi, I'd have an opinion on that.
Well, it may not be our pick, but quite frankly, here are your choices: Saddam, some sort of democracy, or some sort of strongman. What do you guys
want?
Again,
Jim, it's not our pick. We are not the, you know, legislator, the policeman of the world.
No, we're the liberator,
the Iraqi.
Actually.
Again, well, supposedly they now have their sovereignty, so
yes,
they can choose for themselves,
yes,
theoretically,
can.
Whether
thanks
you know
us,
if they
yes
want a theocratic government, if they want to return to a more dictatorial form of government, and somebody's going to come in and take, you know, fill that power vacuum. You know, there's all kinds of things that could happen that may not be an American-style democracy, whether we choose that or not. Mm-hmm. But to return to the idea of, you know, how much money this is going to cost, the other thing to look at here is, now that this is transferring from the Pentagon to the State Department, not only are we still supporting the troops and the massive administrative structure there to support them, but we're building the biggest embassy in the world and have yet to have any special allocation for that.
Patrice, will Iraq, as we know it now, under this new sort of reconstruction, are we looking at Iraq as like a hangnail that's going to be around menacing
absolutely
the American politics and an American taxpayer again?
Yep, absolutely, Jerry. I mean, I would
for a year or two.
I would suggest that we're going to be there for the next 50 years because this is a situation where, you know, we have the Iraqis in a position to choose. What if they choose a form of government that we disapprove of? What if they put in place a theocracy with another leader that we disapprove of? Do we go back in and try to reorganize things and create our form of democracy again? Okay, we've got the largest embassy in the world created in Iraq. What does that tell you? It doesn't mean that we're staying there for 2 or 3 years. We still have 141,000 troops, I believe, is the last number there, and we're calling up vets for reinforcements. Now we have President Bush going to Turkey telling the EU that Turkey should be admitted to the EU. I mean, we're kind of going around telling people what to do with this strong man approach, and it's not going to work. As for Iraq, absolutely, we're going to be there for a long time.
Our telephone number 301-230-0980, #980 of Verizon Wireless System. Our lines are open as we talk with our first Sunday political debate here, our roundtable, Nicholas Sawalk, Jim Pomeli, Emily Leffler, Patrice McKinney, and Eric Mickelson. They're all here to more or less discuss the issues of the day, and we're talking about Iraq, the new government in Iraq. Will it be able to maintain itself? Will it be able to not cost the American taxpayer more dollars? And how long are we going to be saying Iraq? Telephone number 301-230-0980, #980 on Verizon. Jerry in Fairfax, good morning.
Good morning, Jerry.
Go ahead.
I would just like to say that thanks for these folks coming in, driving all the way in from where they came from just to spend 15 minutes with you on the air. I'd like to see you expand this to maybe a half an hour, 45 minutes.
Well, it is. It's, 40 minutes, Steve? Steve Solomon, our technical producer. Yeah, 40 minutes.
But he wants even more.
Yeah, that's supposed
to
be what he wants.
The people have spoken, Jerry.
Yeah, by the time you get through with all the commercials and all the small talk.
No, we don't have commercials. But go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead, Jerry.
I want to thank these folks for coming in every day.
All right, thank you very much.
First Sunday.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very nice. But no, it is, it's rough. No, this is now 50 minutes. I forgot. We expanded it, didn't we?
Yeah, it's about 50 minutes.
Yeah, it's 50 minutes.
We might need another 50.
And we don't have any commercials, anything like that. Only thing we sell is Metro Talk, right here. 301-230-0980, pound 980 on the Verizon Wireless System. Absolutely free call. Our lines open and join the discussion here on this 4th of July, our political roundtable, first Sunday. Emily.
Well, Jerry, to go back to what Maureen Patrice was saying about having a prolonged presence, American presence in Iraq for the next 50 years, I think I would argue that that is exactly what the Republicans are looking for, that the neoconservatives in power started this war for the exact purpose of having an American presence in the Middle East to pursue their goals of supposedly democratizing the Middle East for American purposes, that's their strategy. So I think having an ongoing military and diplomatic presence is exactly what they want, and funneling billions of dollars is exactly what
democracy,
they want.
Democracy, a sinister idea.
Funneling billions of dollars for other people's democracy is a sinister idea.
You know, I think I kind of have to take issue with Emily on this a little bit. I think it's been a bipartisan issue for 50 years. I mean, if you looked at the stronghold that was in Saudi Arabia, in Israel, and other parts of the Middle East, the U.S. has had a tremendous presence there for again, decades. Again, with moving troops out of Saudi Arabia, those folks need some place to be stationed, and I guess the new Iraq is precisely the place that the U.S. government intends to place them.
Well, we could bring them back here.
Why is there such, as you talked with some people about this very issue of a new government, and based on what Jim Pomeroy is saying, the purpose of us being there, the premise as to how it's set up and all, you know, a lot of people are saying, I don't think it's going to work. I mean, well, and now with Saddam Hussein there in court, in American jail, as you said, but is there going to be some type of retaliation? I mean, people going to take to the streets or what?
Well, let me ask you this, Jerry. If in, you know, 1776, the French had come over, just kicked the British out and said, okay, now you guys are independent. You're going to set up your government in the French style, and you're going to have a French-style bureaucracy, and you're going to have a king who is going to be a friend of the French emperor, what would we have done? We would have been trading one power for another, and we wouldn't really have been free. And so why is it that as Americans, as the bastion of freedom, as people who really don't like it when other people tell us what to do, that we are so quick to rush into Iraq and say, you know, this is how you're going to run your government. You're going to elect a democracy. That democracy is not going to have a strict majority rule because that would lead to a theocracy. And so we have two choices here. We can either let Iraq go their own way and do their own thing and let them be truly independent and let those chips fall, or we can spend lots of money, lots of time, and lots of troops to keep running them the way we want.
All right, let's go to Jim, and then I'm going to come to Patrice.
Jim. Welcome to the 4th of July, where the rest of my panelists are really skeptical about actually having democracy anywhere but here, and they seem to show concern for the American taxpayer only when the money's being spent in the interest of freedom in the United States. I mean, it's like I'm Alice in Wonderland here. Now, you guys are being fiscal conservatives.
What?
You guys are being fiscal conservatives, saying Iraq's not worth the money. You know, Patrice is worried, oh, no, our embassy's too big. You know, oh, no.
We just had four teenagers run over a man in Southeast and kill him. We find bank robbers running around robbing banks with automatic machine guns. And you know, need I go on?
So you want our troops back here in the streets taking care of D.C.?
I don't know. A lot of people feel we do need to take care of America.
I would agree with that, Jerry. And I would like to suggest also that people are best prepared to form their own governments for various reasons. Our form of democracy works in the United States because we are fortunate to have one of the wealthiest, richest in natural resources
places
in the world. Are you kidding?
We were a wilderness at the time.
Which is very rich in natural resources and gives any single person the ability to create a business, make money, sustain themselves. We have a country rich in natural resources. You go to Iraq and what do they have? They've got oil. They need to create a form of government that satisfies the needs of the people in the environment in which they live based on their cultural and political history. You cannot take a government, form of government that works in the United States one of the countries that has wealthiest in natural resources and try to impose it in an Arab country.
On a country that has actually more wealth and resources than we had when we won our independence.
Is that the reason why we were there?
No, hold on. Let's back up a second. We're there because Saddam Hussein was backing terrorism around the world.
Well, do we have
with
that around
evidence?
The world?
Where's the evidence for that?
With the money he was sending to suicide bombers, with the support he was giving
suicide
to other programs.
That blew themselves up here in the United States?
Israel, the Middle East.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's a list of things. I know you may not care about suicide bombers in Israel. That's your prerogative.
But I don't like suicide bombers everywhere.
There's a list of things Saddam was doing. He was funding suicide bombers around the world. He was backing terrorists around the world. He was sheltering terrorists in Iraq.
Which terrorists?
I don't think that we have proof of any of this. In fact, I think that we have proof of each of them. None of that is actually true.
Excuse me. We cannot talk together. We can sing together, but not talk together, okay? Now, Jim, you've said your part. Eric, help me out.
I have a couple questions with regard. If Jim's so concerned about democracy, I wonder if he's working to help get voting representation for D.C. in the U.S., if he's also worried about trying to abolish the Electoral College, which is inherently an anti-democratic institution in the United States. I think there are some democracy issues that we could take care of here. Let me just go to the secondary issue now of resources and whatnot. I think that... I forgot my point. I'm sorry.
Well,
while you're trying
to get your point back, let me just simply say that we have here Eric Mickelson, you just heard, from the Green Party, Democrat Patrice McKinney, Independent Emily Loeffler, and Jim Pomeli, the Republican, and sitting next to Jim Pomeli, the Republican, is a Libertarian. His name is Nicholas Starwalk. On the line, Pat in Alexandria.
Nicholas, you were so logical.
Good morning. Really, honest. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, darling. How are you all?
Fine.
I think Nicholas brought up the point. Would we take it if someone was coming in? Frankly, I don't want to be French, but that's neither here nor there. I think that it's wonderful that Mr. Parmley is going to edit the 9/11 report to change Saudis to Iraqis. But I think what we have to realize here is primarily we don't have all the resources. Our resources are going out. We haven't built new refineries. We haven't got the oil. So what we're talking about here is protecting Middle East oil. As far as suicide bombers in Israel, hey, the Israelis do a real good job at knocking those people out. We don't have to worry about what Saddam Hussein did. And as far as it goes, I'm getting really concerned. I think Nicholas is more the Republican of my youth, and Mr. Parmley is probably joining the far left. The rest of you have an absolutely lovely day. Jerry, it is 134 in Fallujah. My son called this morning to wish you a happy 4th of July.
Oh, that's great.
Enjoy, sweetie.
Okay, thank you, my dear Pat.
Okay.
All right, lots of love.
I've joined the far left.
No, we take issue with that.
We on the far left. I really don't think so. Vadim in Loudoun County, good morning.
Good morning. Happy holiday, everybody.
Bye.
Happy holiday.
Happy holiday.
Well, thank you.
I want to just make mention, because I'm... how much United States spent money when they was in the Cold War against USSR and all socialism countries? It was huge money. Right now we're talking about the small Iraq. I think it's nothing compared with USSR, what's been spent for many, many years from beginning of the 50s until 80s, 90s. And I think it's nothing. And we, it's my opinion, the United States do the right politics in the Middle East because it's dangerous countries over there. Anyway, you know this. Russia has been in a war with Afghanistan for many years, and many countries been in war with Middle East. That's all my opinion. That's what I want to say. And happy holidays, everybody.
Thank you very much, sir.
Okay. You're welcome.
Let's move on to the next issue. We've already talked about it a little bit, and that is Saddam Hussein in court. We talked about his being in court. He was very defiant last week in making some statements. First, he started off by saying, "I am the president of Iraq." This sounded kind of strange because they got a new leader in Iraq. I don't know what's going on over there. But anyway, what about Saddam Hussein? How will he be tried, and what's to come of it?
I think he's going to have a fair trial. I mean, I think the Iraqi people will do what is necessary with Hassan. I don't think there's going to be any kind of retaliation. Members of the Ba'athist Party are already being included in the new government, and the religious leaders, Saddam was not a religious leader, so the religious leaders are not going to stand up to back Hassan. I think he's going to be, Saddam Hussein, I think he's going to be tried and fairly punished.
And some religious leaders are calling for his execution.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Can I ask a real quick question?
Mm-hmm.
Did we ever convict Slobodan Milosevic?
I don't know.
Does anyone remember?
No, absolutely. No, he's still there, and it's a drawn-out process, and that's why
have good charges against him, really. I mean, the evidence really hasn't stood up.
All the Muslims he killed, but we're not even getting any.
But he's not being charged by his own country. That's been taken out.
Our telephone number 301-230-0980, pound 980 on Verizon Wireless System, absolutely free call. Lines open as we talk with our panelists this morning about the various issues that we find in our newspapers, on the news, as well as Americans, those issues that affect the pocketbook. And one in particular is D.C., slots in D.C. City officials are thinking about slots in D.C. In my interview with the mayor last week, the mayor says he's not for gambling, but if the people in D.C. want slot machines, he would support that. Well, my question to you, these people have a little bit of the Ehrlich Maryland feeling, fever or what?
I think all of these states, and in the case of D.C., the municipalities, feel like, well, this is one potential way to get easy money. The issue is really that it's almost like an arms race. Effectively, you can see with Maryland, the threat of Maryland or Pennsylvania getting slots, that Virginia's getting ready to upgrade its slots and apparatus and its gambling apparatus so that it's more extensive, and they realize that money will be taken away from them if Maryland gets slots. And so it really is an escalation of absurd proportions.
Well, allow me to reframe the debate for my fellow panelists. The issue and the reason that the D.C. government is fighting slots and the reason that the governments around the country fight slots is because it all comes down to a government monopoly on the lotteries. The state and district lotteries, the lotteries in this country, take 50% of that prize pool and put it in their pocket. So you have poor people. I was up in Baltimore 3 weeks ago going to get a six-pack of beer for a party I was at. And there's a line, 10 people long. It's Friday night. And, you know, I'm just standing in line in this liquor store waiting for my beer. And one of the guys in front of me says, "Oh, no, no, no. This is the numbers line. You can go right up to the window. There's no line to buy beer. We're all here to buy lottery tickets." 10 people standing in front of me on a Friday afternoon there to buy lottery tickets, which has a 50% loss rate. Slot machines, on average, you know, take about 5% off the top of what you put in goes to
the
casino.
So you're saying there's competition between the
government. I'm saying there is competition in gambling, and this is what the governments are afraid of. They've taken this regressive tax on poor people, which are state lotteries, and they're afraid that somebody's going to give them a better deal. They're going to give them some actual fun for their money where they have slot machines go ding, ding, ding.
But then where's your point, Nick? Because what you're suggesting is that introducing a second form of regressive tax is a good thing. Okay, we have lotteries. I'd say
what
a
I'm
lot of people agree that it is not a good thing.
What I am suggesting is that people in this country want to gamble, as evinced by the popularity of Atlantic City and Las Vegas and all these slot machine proposals. So I'm suggesting that there be competition. If the people want to gamble, then the people should be able to have a fair system for gambling in.
Yeah, you know,
wouldn't you agree?
I actually don't have any moral objection to gambling. I think in Maryland, one of the most interesting proposals that I've seen actually occurred in the last legislative session. The Republicans and Governor Ehrlich really wanted to see gambling or slots come to Maryland. And so what did the Speaker of the House, Mike Bush, do? He said, "Okay, look, we'll give you slots. We're going to put them in Republican districts. We're going to put them in the districts where the folks who are voting for slots are going to get the slot machines in their districts." You want to see how fast those people turned around their votes and how unhappy they were about the prospects of slots at that? They don't mind having slots in the poor parts of Baltimore or poor areas of the state, but they don't want those slot machines in their districts because they know exactly what the repercussions of having those kinds of parlors and whatnot will be.
And if we had a fair form of taxation that was generating enough revenue to create jobs for poor people who were spending their time, you know, gambling in order to...
Tax revenue doesn't create jobs.
Tell that to the Department of Homeland Security.
Telephone number 301-230-0980, pound 980 on the Verizon wireless system if you're listening in this morning. I'd like to get your opinion on some of the issues we're discussing with our panelists, Emily Leffler, Independent Democrat, Patrice McKinney, Eric Mickelson, Green Party, and Jim Pomeroy, Republican, Nicholas Sawalk, Libertarian. I'm going to skip the agenda here. We got a lot of other things to get to. We got to get to Dick Cheney. But before we do, I must ask you about Ralph Nader. I mean, everybody in the world has talked about Ralph Nader in this race. And two black leaders have come out and said, Nader, later. What about this?
Well, actually,
friend Eric Mickelson of the Green Party.
It's a good segue to...
I mean, is he or is he not? For what reason is he in this? I mean, what does he bring to the table? Why is he there?
Well,
why does he just
First, let me say that the Green Party of the United States had its nominating convention last week, and they decided to nominate David Cobb, Green from California, excuse me.
Who? To be the
David Cobb.
Cobb Allen.
Who?
You know Cobb Allen. You know where Cobb Allen is, don't you?
Are you not
regardless, he is the Green Party presidential candidate this year. Ralph Nader still is running. He's still trying to get ballot access. He and David Cobb have roughly similar platforms. And I think the reason that either gentleman is running or both are running is because we need a I feel like, and I think a lot of people feel like, we need a presidential candidate who stands firmly against the war, stood firmly against the war, didn't vote for the war or pursue the war, stands against the Patriot Act, stands for universal health care for all Americans, stands for fair wages.
That would be Ralph Nader.
Right, Ralph Nader.
You guys should have voted for Ralph Nader.
Patrice, the concern here, before we go to our phones, the concern here has to do with, will Nader pull from John Kerry?
Absolutely, and that's a big concern. And I would say that's why Elijah Cummings and Congressman Watts had a discussion with Ralph Nader, indicating that, you know, his presence in this campaign is not a healthy addition to the overall process, because he's just going to kind of, you know, take votes away. Absolutely, the Nader people want Bush out, but by voting for Nader, the same thing happened in 2000, where we pulled votes away from the Democratic nominee and lost the election.
So this is, I guess, a group called Democrats Against Democracy. You know, they're not really interested in more political participation.
They took some time away from the Iraqi plan of, you know, how to limit candidacies there, to try and limit candidacies in our country.
No, I'd say building coalitions is a healthy part of a democracy.
Reach out to the left.
Our telephone number, 301-230-0980. Pound 980 in the Verizon wireless system. This is the wildest mixed choir I've ever been in my life. David and Kensington, good morning.
Good morning. I, you know, you guys keep getting me different thoughts. I want to talk for a half hour myself.
Go right on, David.
Somebody spoke up earlier about getting rid of the Electoral College, but now they don't want Ralph Nader to run. It seems kind of...
The same guy said that, too.
What? I didn't say I don't want Ralph Nader to run.
Oh.
I said, I want to get rid of that Electoral College, and I said, Ralph Nader has the right to run.
I'm just curious why you want to get rid of the Electoral College. It was a very Democratic thing to try and even out the power so that the cities or the coast didn't dominate politics across the country.
Because I believe in a popular Democratic election. I don't see what's wrong with that. I think giving certain states a disproportionate amount of weight. Why should the weight of some Americans' votes be greater than others?
No, they're not disproportionate. They're not disproportionate. You know, you have to win the total state. They're proportionate. What you have to do, though, is campaign across the country. You can't simply be a regional candidate. But the Electoral College is set up proportionally.
Wrong. It is. The two senatorial votes that are given as a part of the Electoral College make it disproportionate, so that if you've got a state where you've got two senatorial votes for California versus two senatorial votes for Wyoming, the
other 435 are spread out, so overall it's 98% representation.
Yeah, David, go right ahead.
Well, my next point with regard to the lottery in the state of Maryland, I'm not opposed to having the gambling or the slots come in. What I'm opposed to is giving this jackpot to the horse track or the horse owners or the track owners. I've lived in Montgomery County the majority of my life. I've never been to a track. I don't know why we need to subsidize the horse industry. If it dies on its own, let it die on its own. If it can make it on its own, so be it. If we're going to have slots, let them be in downtown Bethesda.
Okay. Thank you, David.
I totally agree with the caller on, you know, not providing corporate welfare for anybody, whether they're a racetrack or not. I wanted to make one point with regard to Ralph Nader running. there is going to be an anti-war candidate on the ballot in pretty much every state, and he's going to be Michael Badnarik, the Libertarian candidate. Ralph Nader has barely 22 states he's going to be on the ballot in, and David Cobb may have another 20, and they, some places they're the same state. So if Americans really want an anti-war choice, a lot of them aren't going to even see Nader on the ballot. He doesn't have the ballot access.
Telephone number 301-230-0980, pound 980 on Verizon Wireless System. We have lines open, and we'd like to get you involved in this so-called political fanfare that we do every first Sunday of the month, and we call it First Sunday, the political debate. Now, my dear friends, another statement on the agenda this morning, 301-230-0980, pound 980 on Verizon. I'm giving that telephone number again because this should stir up some sparks ready for the fireworks tonight. Dick Cheney, vice president, used the quote-unquote F word to Senator Leahy. Was it proper, regardless reason behind this, was it proper or is it proper for the United States vice president or anybody in leadership role to publicly use foul language to make a point? And then on television say simply, I have no regrets, I'll do it again.
All right, Jim Palmer, get the jump button ready because I'm about to tell you all what I think of you. No, really, I mean, this was not...
Uh-oh.
They're terrified now.
The
no.
chair that you're sitting dumps too.
Now, look, the vice president was expressing himself privately. He wasn't on television. He wasn't on radio.
He was in a public place.
He was in a public place. But I mean, look, he shouldn't
Everything
have been.
Everything he does is public. My taxpaying.
Considering the numbers of people who are, you know, wanting to use the word on the air repeatedly and can't understand.
Well, we don't do that
standards.
On the show.
No, absolutely not.
We have control.
Absolutely not. Well,
but yeah, evidently the vice president doesn't have control.
Dick Cheney, in private conversation with a member of the Senate, told him exactly what he thought of him, and quite frankly,
you agree with him.
I agree with the sentiment, perhaps not the words.
What kind of role does this set for young Americans that we keep telling, don't say that when you go to school, little Johnny and Susie, and here's the vice president. And by the way,
little Johnny and little Susie were not on the floor of the United States Senate listening to this.
I thought it was in a private setting.
It was a private setting.
On the floor of the Senate?
Yeah, the floor of the Senate is
That's a private setting.
Is it open to the public?
Yes. Is it open to the public?
The mics weren't on. This was a photo session.
Well, then how did they get
this? I believe this was the group picture they were taking.
If the mics weren't on, how did we hear it?
Oh, those pesky reporters listening in.
Yeah, there you go. You see, typical Republicans, boy. Emily.
You know, Jerry, I have to ask Jim if little Johnny and little Susie were in the president's study during Monica Gate, too.
Ooh.
You know, here's a... Oh, that's a bad connotation.
Yeah. Little Monica was.
No, but, you know, here's the thing.
The door's wrong
about
the underage children.
I'd like to say I agree with Jim. I have to say... The Senate was not in session. What, you know, elected officials do in their personal and private interactions, I think, is a private matter and, you know, is none of my concern. However, I think it's a major hypocrisy from an administration that ran on the platform of bringing integrity and dignity back to the office. But that's conveniently forgotten because nobody heard it.
Excuse me. Public or private, this man went on television afterwards. And brought it to the public.
The public brought it to him.
Thank God for the media this time.
The same media that wants to use that word every 5 seconds on primetime television decides they want to get upset with him for telling...
The conservative media?
We're talking about journalists. We're not talking about entertainment.
This is ironic, though, Jerry, that this incident occurred the same day that the Decency in Government Act was passed. Now, let's just say, okay, we all know being a politician inherently requires a level of hypocrisy. At least the Democrats have the good sense to be slightly embarrassed when they're caught in their hypocrisy.
Bill Clinton fought it to the very end. Absolutely no embarrassment.
He was caught. Let's just say he was caught. Now, I teach my kids, if you can't come up with a better word to express your feelings than those... You know, five bad words.
You shouldn't be Vice President of the United States.
You shouldn't be Vice President of the United States.
What do you tell your children when they want to abuse the intern?
Can I talk to Damon in Montgomery County? Good morning, Damon.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine, my friend. Go right ahead.
I think the problem with this whole discussion is that we have to figure out the context in which you use the expletive. And it was in response to Leahy's questions about Halliburton and some of the things that had come up. So in terms of the contracts in Iraq and Halliburton and Kellogg Brown Root. So I think that the expletive speaks more to an arrogance than it does necessarily to him just, you know, cursing out of, you know, for whatever reason that he wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
Leahy had been one of his staunchest critics about Halliburton and some of the things that were going on in Iraq. And as I understand it happening, you know, Cheney took umbrage at that, and there was some back and forth, and then Cheney used the expletive. So to me, it speaks more of an arrogance of the administration to kind of do what they want and not want to be questioned on it. End of my comment.
Good point. Hold on the line, please.
Am I the only member of the panel who wonders if it might not be more important that the current administration is sending our troops abroad to die, and they're ripping up the Constitution with, you know, a new version of the Patriot Act, and maybe that's a little more important than what Dick Cheney has to say to Patrick Leahy and what words he uses? Is that just me?
I mean, I agree with Nick, absolutely. And I also think the issue is, I mean, we saw this earlier in the year with the whole Janet Jackson and the exposed breast thing. You know, the Congress spends hours and hours and hours trying to figure out what kind of legislative solution should we get to make sure this doesn't happen again. And again, there's all these other ridiculous, you know, issues going on with regards to, you know, global warfare and whatnot. And we're concerned about, you know, whether or not a breast was flashed on TV for half a second, you know. I'm not saying it's not important, but I think that it just seems like we don't have our priorities in the right place, you know?
Well, I also agree with the caller, and I think that this does play exactly into the administration's overall just general demeanor in politics, whether it's personal or in public. The arrogance that this administration displays, whether it's in private interactions with members of Congress and the Senate or in Iraq, and, you know, we've seen this even this week with some of the cases before the Supreme Court, and where the Supreme Court is saying, no, I'm sorry, the executive does not have sole dominion over, you know, the lives of prisoners and whatnot, regardless of whether we are in a state of war.
Our telephone number 301-230-0980, #980 on Verizon. Damon, are you through?
I was just going to agree with the person that spoke. The arrogance is pervasive. Whenever you talk about the energy policy and the fact that that was done in secret, some would argue, when you talk about, oh, my gosh, just any number of things, the Guantanamo Bay situation, you know, there's always this claim of executive privilege. And, you know, for an American taxpayer, it makes me very uneasy when I don't know what's going on. I think I have a fundamental right to know how the energy policy for my country is being drafted. I think I have a fundamental right to know what my civil liberties are and what my civil liberties aren't. You know, I think I have a fundamental right to many things that I don't seem to get with this administration. It doesn't seem like there's a full disclosure of everything that's going on, and that's very troubling.
Damon, hold on the line, because we have Mike in Annandale, and let's get his input. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. I just jumped in the truck and I was listening, and now I kind of agree with Damon. The arrogance is pervasive on both sides, and you know, for anybody to sit there, you know, like your one panelist there, to say that the arrogance on the Republican side, I mean, you can't point the finger in one direction.
Mm-hmm.
And Damon's right that maybe we should be entitled to a little bit to know a little bit more about what's going on. And also, I caught the tail end of one of your panelists there discussing, you know, we're focusing on the smallest things in the world and taking up all this time with the Janet Jackson incident, for instance. I mean, there are so many more important things that we could be focusing on in Congress that we're not, because of the arrogance of congressmen and congresswomen on both sides of the line.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for your input. Damon and Mike, our telephone number 301-230-0980, #980 on Verizon Wireless System. We have a few more minutes with our panelists this morning as we talk about the issues of the day on this 4th of July. Miss McKinney?
Yeah, Jerry, I'd like
Democrat.
To go back to say, just step back a couple steps to agree with Damon and also Emily, but also to take it another step further. The use of profanity is also, to me, a sign of the defensiveness with which the administration is now put on. You look at the Guantanamo Bay decision. You look at the economy. You look at what's going on in Iraq. And the president is really taking a pummeling in the polls. The whole administration has been put on the defensive, and I think that was part of the frustration that was exhibited by Dick Cheney and his use of profanity.
You know, look, Kerry's campaign, you know, last week called President Bush Hitler. So I think we should be just a little less excited about certain naughty words.
Let's talk to Kevin in Springfield. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. Now, I want to go back into the arrogance talk. It seems to me that back around 9/11, and maybe this was urban legend, maybe I only heard it one or two places, but it seems to me that Rumsfeld at one point in time had tried to create an office of misinformation, and then it just pretty much got swept away. Now, I don't remember if that was urban legend or if that actually did happen.
No, I believe it was actually the kid. I'm not sure it was called the Office of Disinformation, but it was essentially going to be an office that was going to be used to spread sort of propaganda on the part of, was it the State Department or one of the sort of international agencies in foreign countries to sort of, you know, to sort of get down some of the Al Jazeera press and some of the other kinds of alternative presses that were out there to sort of offset that information and put it in a pro-U.S. light.
Okay,
okay,
Kevin?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, my friend. Let's go to Rich in Fairfax. Good morning, Rich.
Yeah, I have a question. Well, I have a comment in that some of the panelists there were saying that it's the administration that makes comments like this. And this was an individual, not an administration. When Clinton did his funny thing in the White House, it was always Clinton. Democratic Party could go ahead and divorce themselves from him as an individual and divorce themselves from that action. Now, all of a sudden, it's always the administration that's got that. And that's all I wanted to say. I think there's a hypocrisy there.
Okay, thank you very much, Rich. Let's go to Elizabeth in Alexandria. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning. I was listening to the panel and some of the callers, and I still have a hard time swallowing what a lot of radio stations and news stations are saying about the administration. When I agree with Rich and that was just on the phone, that when Clinton was in office for 8 years, he took that office to a new low, and the morality of the country went down as a result of it. And as we're talking about what Cheney said to delay what Janet Jackson did at the Super Bowl, it just feeds to the entire nation, I think, is writing off just little courtesies, little by little, whittling it away, until it's just not going to matter how we speak to each other. It's not going to matter how we treat each other. And everyone's going to be able to get away with it. And little by little, we're chipping away at the morality of the country when we should be focusing on bigger issues. And as somebody who supports the war in Iraq, then I think that we should be focusing on what we're trying to do over there rather than whether Dick Cheney is telling off Tom DeLay in a private conversation.
Hey, Elizabeth, hold the line, please. Don't leave, okay?
Okay.
Let's get Joe on his cell phone in. Joe, go right ahead.
Hi, how you doing? I've been listening to your panel for the past 15 minutes or so, and I just wanted to say that there's hypocrisy in both sides. It really irks me that everybody is wasting so much time over this little, what I call it, very little incident. And if I were the vice president, I might have been inclined to use the same language towards Mr. Leahy. It was in a private setting. It was not in public. And what really irks me is the hypocrisy of the government when we need the Senate. One or two people can kill a piece of legislation that it takes 60 votes in the Senate to pass anything, and it's just awful the way this government is run. And it's right now more from the minority of the Democrats in the Senate that are stalling all kinds of important legislation. And you know, the thing about Cheney is it's minor. Get over it. You know, it's just wasting too much time.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Elizabeth. Have a good day. Happy 4th.
I just want to speak to the first caller, Elizabeth, I guess.
Real quickly.
She, you know, Clinton's actions and these other actions are apparently destroying the moral fiber of the country chip by chip, but Cheney tells Leahy to go F himself, and that's a minor issue. We should be worrying about other
issues. There's a difference between perjury before a grand jury and a private conversation.
I'm just saying, let's be consistent. Either these kinds of issues are not consequential things that the Congress should be addressing, or they are.
Just lying to a grand jury is consequential. Telling a senator off, not so much.
Bringing the country to war under false pretenses is another way of eroding the moral fiber of the country, as well as encouraging war profiteering.
He's certainly doing that.
Mr. Sawalk?
Might I suggest that if the American people are looking to their politicians for how to behave and what sort of morality that they should espouse, that perhaps they should look, you know, to their parents or maybe to their religious leaders or pretty much any other better example of good, upstanding moral behavior than politicians?
Good point. Paul in Forestville. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. How's it going?
Fine, my friend. Very quickly.
I just wanted to say everybody just needs to calm down and relax. You know, I'm a Democrat and, you know, I can't stand Cheney, but you know what? It's a word. It's a grouping of letters that really doesn't have any meaning whatsoever. It doesn't really matter what he said, if it was in private, if it was in public. It's the fact that it's his actions that make it so bad that the vice president's just going to stand around and give money to Halliburton, companies that he has had dealings with. He's going to accept money from a company when he's going into the vice presidency, like $31 million from an oil company, before he becomes the second most powerful man in the United States. There's something a little wrong there, and that's what people need to be focusing on, not just some four letters that he happened to say.
Thank you very much, Paul. Appreciate your input. Very quickly, folks, we're going to have to get out of here because I want my good buddy, Kurt Erickson from the Washington Regional Alcohol Program, is going to say a few words just to encourage people on this 4th of July, the importance of Sober Ride. But before we get to that, I want to thank you, Nicholas. Happy 4th.
Happy 4th.
Nicholas Sawalk, Libertarian. I want to thank my good friend Jim Pomeroy, Republican.
Happy Independence Day.
And Emily Leffler, Independent.
Happy 4th of July, Jerry.
Patrice McKinney, Democrat.
Thank you, Jerry. Happy 4th.
And Eric Mickelson, Green Party.
Thanks, Jerry. Happy 4th of July.
And tell Ralph Nader. Anyway, let's turn now to a little bit of the nice thing about America. We disagree, we communicate, and, hey, we're still buddies, we're still friends, we're still family, we're still people, and God knows we're the greatest in the world. Thank you very much to the panel and to you. On behalf of all of us here at WBIG and WTEM and Clear Channel Radio, make it a good weekend, a safe weekend. Happy birthday, America, with much peace and much love. I'm Jerry Phillips. 'Cause there ain't no doubt.